You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1990 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Russ Brierly on the subject, Praising God Through Music.
Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off, and I'm not necessarily running behind. I found out the same thing, that what I had hoped to accomplish in that second day seems to run over into the third, because there's an awful lot of material. And it basically involves my search for historical authenticity. And put in plainer and simpler terms, how were the Psalms really sung? And I really want to share with you some of the information that I obtained in my research. As I mentioned yesterday, after looking at a number of books in the library and the song that was sung to us by Sister Val, and then also the Chichester Psalms, which were presented yesterday, I felt I really had to go to the synagogue music. And the synagogue music, you probably at one time or another you have heard the statement made that the Gregorian chants, as they are presented in the Roman Catholic Church, probably represent the best way in which the Psalms were originally sung. And there seems to be a certain element of truth in that. At least, you do know this, that the Gregorian chants do follow very closely the early synagogue music. The real question is, does the synagogue music preserve the original way in which the Psalms were sung? That's the question. But I felt I had to go through the synagogue chants in order to get where I wanted to go. And so, very fortunately, I just happened to see a little advertisement in the newspaper that the Jewish Adult Studies group was going to feature a course on music. The music of the Psalms. And so I went down and got a tremendous amount of information from it and learned an awful lot about something which is called a tahmim. And remember yesterday, if you can open your handout, remember yesterday when we looked at the Chichester Psalms, we talked about the Hebrew at the top part of the page not being vowel pointed, and the Hebrew at the bottom being vowel pointed. And you can see those vowel points. Take, for example, on that Chichester Psalms page, the first word, Shema, and again, let me point out that when you're reading Hebrew, you're reading from right to left. So that very, very first line, right under "the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," you see those little dots underneath. Or in the case of the third letter over, the Adonai, which is really the YHVH, that third word over is the Yahweh or Jehovah or however it's pronounced. And nobody really knows. Don't let anybody sell you anything. Nobody really knows how it's pronounced. Perhaps Yahweh. But it's not pronounced in the Hebrew. It is pronounced as Adonai, or as you will hear a little bit later, if you're of the very strict sect or a Hasid, it's really pronounced Hashem, or the name. But anyways, you can see the little dot above. That is part of the vowel pointing. and the same. You can see all those little dots, and as I said yesterday, reading Hebrew is like reading personalized license plates. The only difference, the license plates begin at the left, here we begin at the right. But they don't have any vowels in them, and you've got to place the vowels in there yourself if you're reading Hebrew as it is up here. If you were to go to Israel and pick up an Israeli newspaper, you would not have the vowel points in it. It's not vowel pointed. You're expected to know that. But if you were to pick up a prayer book in most synagogues, it would be vowel pointed, just the way it is right here. So anyways, those vowel points basically indicate the vowels that are to be put in and how the words are to be pronounced. Okay, now, this you can see going over to the next page. You can see that line, the first line of Hebrew, is not pointed. Then you go down to the a little bit further, and you can see where the points have been put in. But in addition to that, when you go down to the third line, you can see not only does it have points, but it has an additional set of signs. And they're rather small on this text. I'll admit that, but you can see those signs a little bit later on. And they are two dots, a sign like that, a sign like that, and then you can see the wishbone, and these all have names, and then something looking like a backward L, and something looking like a V turned on its side. These are called the trope signs. And they do not deal with the vowels. They deal with the phrasing or the singing of a particular phrase. And these are actually what you might call a musical notation. And another thing is the reason that they happen to have that particular shape, and as I described it to you, I said like this, or I said like this, or like that, is exactly for that reason. Because they originally came into existence by a method of the song leader or the leader doing exactly that. When he gave that signal, such as this, just the way it's shaped, when he gave that signal, then they would respond in a certain manner and sing the passage in a certain way. And when he gave that signal, again, they would respond in a different manner. So these are basically, they started out as hand signs or hand signals to tell the congregation how to sing the particular phrase. And you can see this particular phrase as it would be chanted. We have it here in a musical form, and it would go something like this. And that is following the trope signs that are above. So now you could say, we've got it. We've got it, we've got these trope signs, and we can go back and determine just how they were sung. Well, there's only one problem. If you were to take the Babylonian Jews and see the way and catalog, as Professor Idelson has done, catalog all of the trope signs and the various manner in which the Babylonian Jews sang those trope signs, and then go down to the Yemenites and catalog the way in which they sang the trope signs, and then go to your Sephardic and your Ashkenazic Jews and your Jews in Egypt and your Ethiopian Jews, every one of them is different. The systems are different. They have certain musical similarities, but they are different. And so now you're left with which trope signs represent the true way in which the Psalms were sung. And so we not only have that problem, but we have another basic problem, is that the synagogue music does not go back beyond the Second Temple. So even if we were to go back and go to the purest, or the Jews which have kept it in its purest form, we would still only be back to the Second Temple. And here is a comment on the music of the Second Temple. It's only a partial tradition of music of the Second Temple, what we have in the synagogues today. And undoubtedly, the music of the Second Temple not only fell far short of that of the first in point of efficiency and number of executants, but was also tinctured with the foreign association of the return of the Jews. And all that is natural. In effect, what it's saying is they didn't have anywhere near the number of performers in the Second Temple, and they didn't have the efficiency or the quality in the Second Temple, and also it was bound to be affected by the foreign elements where the Jews had been and where they had come from. And just one little note here, that if the traditions of the Second Temple exist anywhere in a tolerable pure state, they may perhaps be discovered among the descendants of those Jews who migrated to Egypt about 200 years before Christ to avoid the tyranny of the Seleucids, and who built a temple near Heliopolis. And so what that is simply saying, that is what I just said, you go to the group which has been isolated the most, and maybe there you will find the best traditions of music. But it still seems to go back only to the Second Temple. So there I was, having enjoyed a number of classes on Hebrew music, and even having gotten to the point of taking a few classes on in learning the Hebrew, I was still with a wall in front of me. And just about 3 weeks before I made this presentation at the what used to be the Rockford Bible School, the Great Lakes Bible School, which is now in Wisconsin, just a short period of time before I made that presentation, somebody came up to me in our ecclesia and said, "Have you heard about the work of this woman who has actually gone back and determined exactly how the Psalms were sung?" I said, "No, David, what is it?" He said, "Well, she has gone back and looked at these signs and has come up with the true way in which the Psalms were sung." I said, "You've got to get me that tape." I said 3 weeks, I think it was about a week before Bible school. And so I arranged to meet him, and he gave me the tape. And I went back with all kinds of enthusiasm, and no time to check it out from an academic standpoint, but it sounded great. And I said, "I'm really not an academician, I'm a showman, so I'm going to use it." And so anyways, let's turn to that page which has this text on it. And I think having introduced you to, first of all, the vowel pointing, and then secondly, the trope signs, or the ta'amim, I think you can now understand what we're going to read right here. This is the dust cover. This is the dust cover, only I don't think they call it that on a compact disc, but you all understand what it is. This is the blurb that's written by Madison Ave to convince people to buy the disc. So this is what we're reading. Bear that in mind. To sum up in a few lines, the fundamental restitution performed by Suzanne Hike Ventura, the Hebraic Bible, the Old Testament, in its entirety, an immense vocal score, the musical signs are indeed notated on either side of the Hebrew text. But these signs had become as hermetically sealed as Egyptian hieroglyphics before the work of Champollion, which is her work, okay? Leaving aside the empirical interpretations practiced up to the present day and for many centuries in the synagogue, that's exactly what I just introduced you to. Leaving those aside, Suzanne Hauck Ventura scrutinized only the biblical signs. After trying out many hypotheses, deductions, and experiments, she discovered the key to that ancient notation. She revealed the significance of the musical signs and finally revived and transcribed in modern notation the music which was regarded, which was revealed to her following methodical, deciphering, and irrefutable verification, whereas the cantillation of the synagogue, varying for the same text from one country to another, that's just what I just pointed out, could not claim any logical justification. Besides the rigorous method needed to direct such an enterprise, this deciphering required the sensitivity of a musician. Suzanne Hike Ventura is actually a composer, to rediscover the patterns of a lost music and to check constantly the foundations of musical expression contained in that ancient notation. The result of those years of labor is a historical work which has convinced musicologists as well as Hebrew scholars, and the revelation of musical treasures which have already seduced the greatest composers. The work which we have just summed up in a few lines has already been the subject of an extremely dense book. It's dense to the tune of 503 pages, all written in French, in which Suzanne Hike Ventura takes pains to leave no point, historical, technical, or musical, in doubt. Now, unfortunately, with about 3 days to Bible school, I could not read the book, and even if I had it in front of me, I can't read French. So anyways, I said, I'm going to use it, I'm going to play it, and I'm just going to present it to them as it is. So what I want to do now is take that beautiful psalm, that psalm when they brought the temple, brought the ark up to Jerusalem, that we looked at the first day, that psalm there, Psalm 24, and we're going to go back and we're going to listen to it right now as it is on Miss Ventura's presentation. This is Psalm 24, and if you don't notice anything else, note the abrupt change in the music where you get to the point where we see, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, yea, lift them up," at the point at which the music really does seem to change. You start out, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, who shall ascend unto the mountain of the Lord." And then you get this abrupt change as they approach the gates themselves. "Lift up your heads, O ye gates, and be lifted up, ye everlasting doors." And you can note that. So this, perhaps, is the closest you'll ever get to hearing this side of the kingdom, what the music of the temple really was like. And if you're going to expect something like what you've heard from our hymn, "Lift Up the Gates," or our anthem in four-part harmony in our scale, you're going to be disappointed. But let's listen to it and see what you think. Thank you. Do you have a soprano attenuation? Selah at the end. Who then is this King of Glory? The Lord of Hosts, Adonai. Over a period of time, Christadelphian has become very familiar with a number of Hebrew words, and you could hear them. The Lord of Hosts, He is the King of Glory. So to kind of continue the story, I was tremendously excited that I had found this, and I went down to the synagogue one Friday night and got talking with the organist, and I said, "Are you familiar at all with the work of Suzanne Heike Ventura?" And she says, "Oh yeah, she's a fraud." So I said, "Well, tell me, where is there something written? Because I had combed the libraries to find something, some commentary on this." And she said, "Well, there was something on national radio." Now, of course, national radio didn't make that statement, but I can give you the name of a musicologist who is very knowledgeable on this. Great. So I got his name, Dr. Herman Belinsky, and he's up in Washington, D.C. So this was right after Bible school, and so I called him up, and he was very open and very free, and we had a long discussion, and he explained to me some of the reasons why he believed that there is absolutely nothing intrinsic in the trope signs themselves, and how it's really impossible for her to have done this work, and that he was in the process of writing a paper. And I said, "I'd like to meet with you." And my son goes to school right up in Washington, or near Washington, and I come up occasionally, so could we set up a time? And so he said, "That would be fine, but I'm going out to the West Coast for the summer, and I won't be back. Call me in September." Well, I think it wasn't until about November that I got back, that I was going to bring my son up, and I called him up, and all of a sudden, things had totally changed. He said, "I'm not saying a thing." He said, "Miss Ventura has her attorneys out and is very litigious, I probably did not pronounce that right, and is in the process of trying to find anybody that's making any charges against her claims or any charges of fraud and is suing. So I refuse to say anything further until my work is published. So I've had a number of discussions with the organist at the synagogue, and she is keeping her eye out for me on this whole matter for the for his publication when it comes out. So I really feel I have to tell you that this is being challenged. It's in the process of being challenged right now. But let's just listen to one more short psalm by Susanne Hike Ventura, and then we'll leave this and we'll go on to a little bit different subject. One of the psalms that I have recorded, and this is Psalm 150, which is what you're going to hear now. Before we leave this whole subject of how the Psalms were performed and go on to the Christadelphian book, which we may get started on today, or perhaps we'll cover that tomorrow, I'm not sure. I would like to do just one thing, and I'd like to take a look at what is often called the touchstone of Judaism. And because we have this close identity with the Jew tremendous love and respect for the Old Testament and that portion of the Old Testament in which this is found, I'd like us to just look at one thing that the Jews learn, and maybe we can learn it today and sing it, and that is the what's called the Shema. And if you just go back to that page with the Chichester Psalms on it, you can see down at the bottom of the page, and there again we have the three presentations. On the left-hand side, we have the English. On the right-hand side of the page, we have the actual Hebrew script. And then down below it, you have a transliteration, which is the Hebrew, but in the English. So you can read it. So let's just look at the first line of the Shema, which is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Shema, Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad." Remember, I said that when you have an H with a dot underneath it, that is your het. And you, it's the guttural, and I put a guttural in where it wasn't supposed to be. That shows you what an amateur you're dealing with here. Let's listen to one presentation of this. These have a tendency to get very, very elaborate. The first one we're going to listen to is also Susanne Hoek Ventura's presentation of the Shema. Listen to the difference, and you will also hear a difference here relative to whether or not it's Adonai or whether it's Hashem.
Oh.
That second section is called the Vyahafta. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And probably the average Jewish young person in his Hebrew school would learn that also. Listen now to a different presentation, and this is done by Simon Haas, the cantor at the Central Synagogue in London. And this group evidently has a much more Hasidic orientation, and you're not going to hear Adonai, you're going to hear the word Hashem, which is the name. And the Hasid are so hesitant to use anything concerned with the name of God, they go way back, right, and just simply say the name. And that, so listen now to this presentation. Second interval didn't work. Let's just try that. Did you pick it up? Not that one. Okay. What we're going to do is the typical normal version that's done in every synagogue. Well, not every synagogue, but most synagogues. And it's very, very simple. It's Shema Israel Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Did you want? Yeah, let's give it a try with the piano. Excuse me. Yeah, good. That should do it. Okay. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu. Adonai Echad. Next year we'll do the Vyahafta. There's one more concept that I'd like to deal with here, and that's making the Psalms something personal. Now, in our hymn book, and when we go through the hymn book, we're going to see that these things have been almost cut out. But in chapter the 28th, 29th, and so forth, in those psalms, we have four chants left. Now, what's called the old Suffolk Street book had a lot of psalms in it that were pointed for chanting. And this seems to be something that is just disappearing, or at least it's disappearing in the American culture. And so we're getting, you know, further and further away from the Psalms. We don't really use them in our service because we don't use them in chanting. Now, the first 41 hymns in our book are Psalms, but they're Psalms that are have been structured with a metrical structure to them. But one brother has done something with the Psalms, and I think many of us can do it, perhaps not with the piano, but he just sings them in a freestyle manner. And He does this not for anyone else's benefit, but strictly for his own. And of course, his God whom he praises. And I'd like to just give you an example of one brother who has taken the Psalms and given it a tremendous meaning to himself. And this is what he does with the Psalms. And this is Psalm 34, if you'd like to follow it. I wanted you to hear that because it's a way one brother makes the Psalms meaningful to himself. And I think a lot of us can do that. When we're singing to ourselves, when we just open the Bible and chant or sing the Psalms, I think it adds a tremendous meaning to it. And who cares if it's a musical performance? You're doing this as a praise to God. And it's a beautiful way of handling the Psalms. We've just about drawn to a close today. Tomorrow we're going to go into an entirely different subject, and tomorrow's subject will be the Christadelphian books. And I say books because we're going to go through each of the ones that are in English, and then we're going to take a look at the Spanish Christadelphian book. So let's in to close today, and I wonder if you've all been thinking in terms of that threefold charge and perhaps looking at the hymns to see if the threefold charge is there in each one. And of course we won't find it clearly, but we will find elements of each part of it. Petition, thanksgiving, and praise. And sometimes we find some hymns lean more toward thanksgiving, some lean more toward praise, and some to petition. But this one here that we're going to sing, hymn number 66, seems to have at least two elements quite strongly, that of thanksgiving and that of praise. And perhaps I think we could say that petition is implied. Hymn 66, and so let us stand and close with the singing of hymn 66. And after that, I'd like to ask Brother Ray to lead us in a prayer.
O Lord of heaven and